Hello, everyone. This is Dark Journalist. Tonight, we have a very special show for you. UC Berkeley professor Peter Dale Scott, who coined the terms deep politics, deep events, and the deep state, will be here to give us his profound insights on the current political tensions and the forces that form a deep state, including the CIA, organized crime, Wall Street powers, and unchecked covert operators. The professor will share his deep concern on the continuity of government, COG program, and the unconstitutional emergency powers granted after the September 11th attacks that are signed each year by both Republicans and Democrats, right and left, that keep us under a state of emergency right up to today. The COG protocols and the NORTHCOM command structures set to implement them are so secret that they are not allowed to be discussed in government. Strangely, the mainstream media has been floating the benefits of COG after years of denying it even existed. Are they laying the groundwork for a COG takeover? And why isn't Congress more concerned about these emergency powers? Professor Scott will share his letters to Congress on the matter and the dangers of COG filling the power void in a disputed election. Are we living under a secret system of power that supersedes the Constitution? Professor Scott will offer his answers and insights from a distinguished career of political research and exposing hidden machinations of power and covert action, from the JFK assassination, Watergate, 9/11, CIA drug running, suspension of the Constitution, and the formation of the deep state. He explains that the deep state has made a series of revolts against the White House, starting with the Kennedy administration and culminating in their current battle against President Trump. He also shows that the deep state is not monolithic, but a series of forces operating behind the scenes to set up a secret system of power by using a covert channel of communications called the Doomsday Network. Here we go, Professor Peter Dale Scott, the Deep State COG Doomsday Network Threat. Professor, it's great to have you back. One thing we should start with right off the bat is a favorite theme of yours, covert versus public powers.
There are private powers in this country as well as public powers. The public powers are thankfully limited by a constitution, and there is nothing limiting the private powers. So that residue is the deep state. But I think the deep state, for a long time, it was essentially polycentric, and I say in my book that it's wrong to think of it as a structure. Mike Loefken in his book talks about it like an iceberg, most parts of which you can't see. And that's a helpful reminder, but what's wrong with it is that it suggests that what you can't see is also solid like what you can see. And essentially, it's much more amorphous than that. And I said in my book, it's more like a system, like a weather system, which is a weather system is very hard to define, but nobody can doubt that when you have a hurricane, it can be very, very powerful. And that is the situation we're dealing with, I think. All our politics are a process. Even the state is a process. But the most fluid and difficult to define part of the process is the part that is not limited by constitutional instruments that give it a kind of positive definition. So I pointed to the areas of it that I think are important. And I would like to begin with big money, because we have more of it than we've ever had. The top 1% of 1% is becoming a really significant factor in our politics. And with the tax changes of Trump, they're more powerful than before. Well, let's look at the deep state that Trump looks at. He's very aware of sort of an ongoing presence in the Washington system, and particularly in what I call the Beltway institutions, the CIA, the NSA, and also the FBI. And they're very important. Most of those are post-World War II, and they have given a kind of implementation to private power, because it would be very wrong to think that the CIA is something created by the president and therefore answering to the president. It was something lobbied for very intently by Wall Street lawyers and bankers, particularly Alan Dulles when he was a lawyer. And Truman, way back then, didn't want it. And in 1945, when there was a move to turn the wartime OSS into a peacetime CIA, he vetoed the plan, abolished the OSS, thought he had dealt with it. 2 years later, he capitulated reluctantly, and they passed the National Security Act that created the CIA. But it was very interesting that as long as Truman was president, he had to choose several directors of it. None of them came from New York. They were all from the central states, some of them from the military, like General Beadle Smith. But underneath that level, the deputy directors were almost all of them, either from not just the upper echelons of finance in New York City, but also significantly the social register, the list of people whose family made them a kind of local aristocracy, if you like, the people with Dutch names like Roosevelt and so on. Those were the deputy directors. There was a big fight in 1948 when there was the Italian election was coming up. They were aware that Russia was putting money behind the communists, and they started to pass the hat at very fancy clubs in New York. And James Forrestal said he was a James Forrestal came out of New York, that high level thing, but he was now Secretary of Defense. He said the government should not do this. It should be a private operation. And Alan Dulles, who was only a private lawyer at Sullivan and Cromwell, perhaps the most powerful law firm in the country then, said, no, it has to be public. And the Secretary of Defense lost, and the private lawyer at Sullivan and Cromwell won, and the CIA set up a new subdivision called Office of Policy and Coordination, which meant really the Department of Dirty Tricks, and that launched the CIA on a new kind of career that had nothing to do with gathering intelligence and everything to do with dirty tricks all around the globe. Now, that's the deep state that Trump is attacking. But if we concede that big money is at the very top of this whole machine, we have to see that a good deal of the big money is backing Trump, because even if they don't like him personally, and some of them wouldn't even probably want to be in the same room as him, but he's very useful to them because he is doing things like, well, the most significant thing was the tax reform, which was a wonderful gift to the top 1% of 1%, masked as a gift to the working classes, which it wasn't at all. So, but that's part of it. But then there is an establishment side to the deep state, and there has always been a counter-establishment side. Most people remember the John Birch Society, and we've watched the John Birch Society. By the way, the John Birch Society, there's a whole book written about it as a populist movement, very misleading. It had nothing. It was started, there was a meeting of 11 people, and 10 of them were officials of the National Association of Manufacturers.
Right.
And that was the group that represented, well, as the title says, manufacturers, the heavy industry people who wanted to, concerned about domestic markets and maybe about Latin America, and always fighting with the people in New York, the financial people in the Council on Foreign Relations. So that split between domestic nationalist business and international finance interests, that is at the bottom of the deep state and its problems, and in a sense of our present crisis now. we also are, in a sense, refighting the Civil War, which is being fought continuously, really, since the peace was declared back in the 1860s. But that is, I think, less deep at the core of the tension in our country than the distinct different economic interests of people. I would say New York, because that represents international finance, and say Texas, which represents domestic nationalism.
That is fascinating. And it suggests then, as you say, that the deep state is not a monolith. It's more of a system.
Right. It always has been. It has been a matter of tension between different groups. And each of us are living in a milieu. Me and my friends, we read the New York Times, and we feel there's a kind of consensus because we always get the same mindset from the Times and the big TV networks. And now that we have cable, you can see the difference more clearly, that we have MSNBC and CNN reinforcing the New York Times. Now we have Fox News and the Murdoch interests. And I should mention also, this new phenomenon, the Epoch Times, which seems to be some kind of nationalist Chinese money, overtly concerned with defending the Falun Gong, but their interests, I think, go way beyond that. And I make a point, I don't want to read the media that agree with me. I want to read the media that don't agree with me.
Right.
So I spend more of my time with Fox News and increasingly with Epoch Times, and now with, I don't want to name them, but even more far out groups.
Fascinating. Now, something we're going to go deep on today is the continuity of government, COG. Now, you've done the most profound research on this for decades. What is it? How can it best be described? And what are the ramifications of its existence in a constitutional republic?
Something which the deep state has produced and got implementation on 9/11 of a series of secret powers that are designed for continuity of government. The original idea is, what happens if an atom bomb hits Washington and the whole American government is decapitated? You lose not only the president and the vice president, but everybody in the succession. So they started way back in the 50s to plan for continuity of government, COG, three important letters, COG. They started planning for it in the 50s. And then under Reagan, it took a new turn. In 1994, it was announced publicly that planning for an atomic attack had been stopped, which was true but very misleading, because COG planning had not stopped, and it continued with a new target, terrorism.
So there is a danger there that the government will call the citizens terrorists and use military force to compel their behavior.
There are statutes against the use of, we call them the statutes which forbid the use of the armed forces.
Oh, posse comitatus.
Posse comitatus. Thanks. Yeah. Thank you very much. Yes. And that Trump, I don't think, it's difficult for Trump to think in terms of what's legal and what's not legal. He just likes to do things, and he's very impatient. It's like his attitude towards the tax laws, for example. You know, you try to get around them as best you can. And he doesn't care much for posse comitatus. So I see a situation where Trump is really seriously threatening. I mean, it's more than just a threat now. He's, in a sense, already doing it. He's weakening public confidence that the election is going to work and going to be a success. Don't lose faith in the system. Use the system to make sure that we keep the system in place. But Trump knows that he has COG powers, which were accurately described, I think, as a suspension of the Constitution.
Right.
And we should be worried that because this all comes out of the fact that we have a deep state, and that under Reagan, a team of people, they weren't all government people, they were private people, were planning for a suspension of the Constitution. And it's very interesting that two of the people doing the planning were Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. And in the 1990s, they were participating in this planning when neither of them was in the government. Both were heads of major corporations. One was Big Pharma, the other, Cheney, was Big Oil. And Big Oil is a very, very central part of the deep state, because Big Oil wants it wants very much, if it goes and invests in Kazakhstan, which it did in the 1990s in a big way, it wants to have U.S. troops nearby to make sure that the president of Kazakhstan doesn't knuckle under to Moscow. And Rumsfeld and Cheney implemented, this is a fact, they implemented COG on September the 11th, 2001, in response to the 9/11 attacks. In fact, before the last plane had hit the ground, they had implemented COG, and it's been in force ever since, and it was actually augmented by George W. Bush shortly before he left office. And that was when the House Homeland Security Committee, a member of the committee which had supervised Homeland Security, wanted to see these augmentations, was told he didn't have the classification to do it. So then the chairman of the committee signed a letter saying the committee wants to see these, and the chairman was told that they didn't have the clearance to do it. So now we have a situation where we think we live in a constitutional government, but they're overshadowing the government is the existing of a second group of rules that Congress doesn't have the power to look at.
No question. You make a point often that each president, when they get in office, they have to reaffirm those emergency powers. And you have presidents as diverse as Obama and Trump reaffirming the same emergency COG powers.
Yes. The emergency powers were handled very sloppily up until Watergate. And then in the course of investigating Watergate, they found out something that attorney generals hadn't known, that America was still in a state of emergency from the Korean War. And so the first thing they did was terminate that state of emergency. And then in what we call the church reforms, or the post-Watergate reforms, one very important reform was the National Emergencies Act, which tried to establish some kind of procedures for national emergencies. And because emergencies are emergencies, the president has the power to declare one quickly. There's not much control over how he does it. But written into the statute was a requirement that Congress, both each House of Congress, has to review a state of emergency within 6 months and either approve it or terminate it. And the interesting thing is, and also in response to what you said, another requirement is that a state of emergency can only last for a year, and then it has to be renewed. Well, two interesting things have happened. The first is that every president has renewed it since 9/11. When Obama was elected, a former congressman and I appealed through the internet to get people to have Congress review the thing and terminate the state of emergency. Nothing happened then, but Obama very quietly, it doesn't make that newspapers, but once a year, every president, Obama, just as much as Bush and just as much as Trump, they all renew the state of emergency. That just happened again last month, the anniversary of 9/11. So now I think it's more urgent than ever that Congress should do what it is required to do. But as far as we know, it's never been done. There is no record at all that Congress has ever handled this, even though the statute says that they must. That they must, not that they may, but they must. And back in 2009, when this congressman, former congressman, and I were appealing nationally, somebody reported back to us that their congressman had said that that requirement in the act had been overridden by continuity of government measures, which would be a real case of the private, the secret constitution overriding public statutes and public law.
Remarkable. You got together with Daniel Ellsberg recently and reached out to Congress again with the same request: would they look at this Emergency Powers Act?
Yes, that's right. It was just 2 months ago in August. There's a group of us in here in San Francisco, the Left Coast, that worry about these things. And it was agreed that Dan and I should appeal. So luckily, my congresswoman is Barbara Lee, the only person who voted against the Patriot Act, which was the equivalent of what, you know, she had one vote in two houses. So she was the right person to write to.
Yes.
And Dan and I wrote a letter together. And I appended to the letter an article. If you Google for me and continuity of government, you can see online everything that I've been saying in this broadcast. You can read it at your leisure. And I appended one of those articles to the letter, and Dan wrote his own letter. And the whole package was sent over to the House Judiciary Committee. So this is a lot better luck than I had in 2009.
Oh, that's
now cool. Inside the congressional system. But I was warned, or Dan and I were warned, not to get our hopes up too high, because it went to the Judiciary Committee at the same time that the Democrats were trying very hard to extend support for the people who've been blindsided by COVID and need financial support. And the economy needs that money in the economy.
Yes.
So, of course, from our point of view, you want to preserve the economy and the well-being of people, but you also want to preserve the Constitution.
Right, exactly. Now, for an average person just learning about these secret powers, how would you recommend they see this?
I would say learn a bit about COG, the National Emergencies Act, and appeal to your congressman, Republican or Democratic.
If you were to look at the election from the perspective of those forces in the deep state, what is the deep state looking at with the election? For example, wouldn't elements of the deep state be interested in activating right-wing extremists and left-wing extremists to create a kind of chaos and somehow thrive in that environment?
You know, this is a very big, very good question, and I don't want to be talking for all day about this. At the very bottom of this, I think, is what they used to call the Vietnam syndrome, that after Vietnam, you had a very powerful anti-war mentality in the country. And Cheney and Rumsfeld knew before they were elected, they were in this project for the New American Century, which talked about the need for a forward strategy and the need for bases where the oil fields were, which is in, at that time, they thought the big oil reserves not developed were Central Asia. And they got it. They got Iraq and they got Afghanistan. But they also got COG, which I think was fundamentally planned to neutralize any future anti-war movement, that you would never again have a situation where America could not wage a war abroad successfully because of a powerful anti-war movement. And I must say, they've been pretty successful in that. That's not relevant right now. But there, yes, the oil companies will always want that kind of power. And so they are interested in maintaining the vigor and power of COG.
So these protests we're looking at could be other forces playing both sides.
So yes, there is backing for violence. And there are questions about all these groups all across the country. They look a bit like Antifa, you know, totally decentralized, Proud Boys here, Boogaloo Boys there, Group Me somewhere else. But they're well armed and better armed than they ever were in the 70s. Where they, these, if these are really fringe people, marginal people, a lot of them are veterans who came back from Iraq with PTSD and have not been able to settle down and are very angry. But where do those people get the money for the kind of armaments that they've been carrying on their shoulders in these riots? So I think there's a lot we don't know, and we're not going to have time before the election to learn very much. But I think we know enough to say we have a very big problem, and we should be very focused on saving the election, saving the Constitution, opposing the use of emergency powers. And the best way, and I go back to my pipe dream, is to get Congress to use the power that it is required to do, which is to consider the emergency powers that were implemented after 9/11, only supposed to last a year, are still there and apparently have never been looked at by Congress, so they're supposed to do it within 6 months.
Now, this is interesting because you would think, for example, the Democratic Congress would want to restrain a president with COG powers, but even they aren't coming forward and saying, get rid of those emergency powers. There's a kind of agreement somewhere to keep those emergency powers in place.
I think there's an agreement not to talk about them. I'm glad you noticed that. I don't have anything solid to tell you about this, but I've noticed the same thing. I noticed, for example, Gary Hart, former senator, former presidential candidate, who was undone by a dirty trick.
In 1988.
Yes, and the young lady in question. I met Gary Hart once, and I said, "Did you know that the lady who ended your political hopes was a member of the harem that Khashoggi kept on his yacht in France?"
Wow.
And Gary Hart had never heard of this. He said, and then he told me a couple of strange things that he had noticed. Yes, I think John Edwards was undone by the same kind of.
Is that Donna Rice?
Yes.
Fascinating.
I'm afraid that's a single source. A good journalist wouldn't say that, particularly about an individual, until you had good sourcing. I have only one source, but I trust the source that I had.
Well, it's so interesting because Khashoggi plays such a big part in your research when you're looking at the deep state.
Yes, and by the way, this is not the Khashoggi who was dismembered in the Saudi embassy and Jamal Khashoggi. It's another Khashoggi who got a percentage of all the arms sales to Saudi Arabia, and this made him, according to a book about him, the world's richest man. At one point. He fell on bad ways later on.
Professor, you've always been a great one for looking at many sides of how this deep political process plays out. Let's look at the neoliberals for a moment. They were doing so well under Obama, making money, and they really want that sort of pot of gold situation back again. They're united with Biden and the media to get back to their kind of establishment corruption. How does it look for them?
Let's think big here for a moment. What's going on here in America isn't just going on here in America. You have something rather like it in England. For a while, you had something with Boris Johnson, who's a Trump lookalike as well as a mimic.
Yes.
And in France, you had Le Pen. And
yes.
Steve Bannon, by the way, when he was managing the Trump campaign and before that was involved in Brexit in England, there is a kind of international movement now against the kind of International Trade Organization, GATT, all these order and international trade, the annual meetings in Switzerland and all of that. There's a counter movement to that all over the world. You have Duterte in the Philippines. You have Modi in India. That's a very serious one, by the way. I mean, you know that the man who assassinated Gandhi is now being venerated as a kind of saint, and that they are planning to build statues in his honor. That is the new mentality in India. And that is a token of what's happening, as I say, over the world. In Indonesia, which is a country I happen to know something about, because for my pains I wrote a long poem about the big massacre in 65 in Indonesia. And this is going on there too. And by the way, one of the top leaders in it is a friend of Trump's who came to Trump's inaugural. These people who are against the old system are not just acting locally. Trump is in touch with them. And I think some of it, you know, I understand China and Russia wanting to see a new economic system. They feel that they were marginalized and minoritized in the old system. And that seems to me an appropriate kind of thing to do. But all of the things that are happening in countries like India goes way beyond that. And I'm afraid I'm too old at 91 to really keep abreast of everything that's happening. I'm now writing about a much happier period, which is the Dark Ages, which much easier for me to be optimistic about than what's happening right now. We are, in a sense, in the new, or threatened with the possibility of the new Dark Ages, and that is why I'm writing about the Dark Ages. But I don't know. I'm not an authority on what's going on in the world now, but I know enough just to zero in on things that should happen between now and January when we hope the winner of the election takes power, and we hope that it is an orderly election. And that is that we should be aware of the threat to the process of the election. We should be aware of the role of paramilitary right in increasing the chances that the election does not take place as planned. The existence of COG powers. Well, I could say more, but those big three, I think, are things that everybody should focus on and study up for themselves.
Do you feel that the, this is interesting to me, because when Trump came in originally, a portion of the deep state, the CIA aspect, they wanted to push him out almost at all costs.
Oh, I think they still do, yes. Interesting, you know, the CIA, by the way, was modified towards, because Gina Haspel, who's the present head of the CIA, she was the head of a torture unit.
Yes.
She was a supervisor of a torture unit, and there were many people in the CIA who hadn't known about the torture when it happened, were very embarrassed by it, and so on, and now one of those people is leading it.
But that CIA portion that resisted Trump and wanted him out, that kind of that branch, they are looking at this and saying, we don't want to have him in there for four more years. So it's an interesting thing, because we go in this from a few different levels, because that part of the deep state is resistant to him.
Yes.
This kind of Blackstone part is on his side, but there are two different sides of the deep state.
Yes, that's exactly right. And notice that a lot of the people who Trump has kicked out, like John Brennan, for example, was the head of the CIA, right, and on MSNBC. They're part of they've become the minority complaining in the wings against what the new establishment, which has to be distinguished from the old establishment, is doing.
Yes.
I'm not 100% on one side in this, because I got into all this politics because of my opposition to the Vietnam War. And right. I am passionately nonviolent, and so that makes me anti-Antifa. and as well as anti-group me and pro-Gandhi and anti-Modi and the new people in India who are explicitly anti-Gandhi. And I am very worried that if we just re-elect Biden and do nothing more, we're going to go back to the old establishment that will do everything it can to protect the defense budget and protect covert operations like the shocking things that happened under Obama in Libya, where we destroyed, I mean, I was no fan of Gaddafi. He was, you could say, an evil man. Yeah. But the situation we have now, thanks to Hillary Clinton and the Obama State Department and the Obama CIA, is terrible. And the same with Syria. That, again, I haven't really kept up on Syria, but a lot of the arms that were left over from what happened in Libya, the CIA was shipping them or overseeing the shipment of those arms to Syria into the hands which they called, they always said they were, you know, a legitimate opposition, but they were, those arms ended up in the hands of ISIS and their allies.
Yes.
We have, you know, we say we face an enemy in Al-Qaeda and an enemy in ISIS. Both of those enemies are synthetic projects which are the results of U.S. policies in Afghanistan and in Libya and in Syria. And that is very easy to document, that the first cadres of Al-Qaeda were people that the CIA had been shipping money and armaments to when the Soviets were still in Afghanistan.
We gave them the tools.
Yes. And you can blame Pakistan, because Pakistan is really does not want an independent Afghanistan. They want a kind of neutral area which can allow them to play their big games against Moscow in Central Asia. And Turkey, I'm afraid, has got a hand in there too. They all want to play the, what did they call them, the Great Game.
Yes.
Kipling's name for it.
And it's interesting you mentioned Turkey, because this is where you got that term, the deep state, and used it for American politics.
Yes, you had an embarrassing moment in Turkish history where there was a speeding Mercedes was wrecked, and among the victims in the car were a member of parliament and a police chief and the head of a terrorist organization that was killing leftists. And there was a CIA touch to, not to the speeding car, but to the whole setting up of this parastate or deep state in Turkey. They say, you know, everything ties together in the most extraordinary ways. The man in the car, Chatley, is supposed to have come to America in 1982 with a leading terrorist, Della Chiaia, an Italian, who was responsible for mass murders in Bolivia. You know, they have always been a kind of international
network,
extremist deep state, marginal in some ways. But if they're so marginal, how come they're able to enter the United States? The answer is that the CIA has always worked with marginal people. And it's cost us very dearly. And, you know, among the reforms is for the CIA to stop sending money and armaments to killers, and then for the Defense Department to stop sending big-time arms to countries like Saudi Arabia, who then sell off their used arms to smaller countries. And so we get this whole war in Yemen, which is a horrible breach of human rights. And if people had to go to the International Tribunal Court because of what happened in Rwanda, then people should have to go to that same court for what's happened in Yemen. And I'm afraid that there are Americans who would have to go to that court, which is why I think America doesn't recognize the international court, so that we are, in a way, opponents of international law and international order, because the CIA and the oil companies have such a deep vested interest in breaking international laws for their own purposes.
You mentioned that the CIA's original charter, we've never even seen their full charter in the public.
Right. There was a statute, and there was an innocent little clause that the CIA would be engaged in intelligence, and it says, and such other activities as the director of central intelligence may from time to time direct. I don't know how big they thought it would be then, but, you know, it was the price of containment. There was two big issues back then were, do we contain the Soviet Union or do we roll back communism? And the moderate position was to contain it. But it wasn't all that moderate, because the architect of containment said, we will draw the lines where they are. And because Russia's got covert elements working against us on our side, we will set up covert elements on their side. Oh, so there was always in the, you know, Truman said after the Kennedy assassination, Truman had a very appropriate response to it. He said, I never intended the CIA to get into the kinds of things they did. And I think Alan Dulles or somebody flew out to Independence, Missouri to get him to back down on that statement. And he didn't.
He didn't.
But it was the mass media, who are part of the deep state, they sort of massaged what Truman said and really said that he didn't know what he was talking about, even though he was the president who had signed the act. But yes.
Do you think that Truman wrote that editorial in direct response to the Kennedy assassination and the CIA's involvement?
I do. Yes, I do. And I'm not sure how much he knew, but I think he was deeply troubled, and he was right to be deeply troubled. And by the way, I don't say the CIA killed Kennedy.
Right.
I say that there was a deep state conspiracy to kill Kennedy, and it involved the fact that the CIA, 8 weeks before November 22nd, when Kennedy was killed, had opened a counterintelligence operation built around the name of Lee Harvey Oswald. And when they keep saying that Oswald was a loner who wanted to be recognized, the real fact of the matter was the CIA wanted Oswald to look at a loner because I didn't say Oswald is involved in the operation. I said his name was involved in the operation. But the CIA obviously had to go to great lengths to make sure that that fact did not come out in the Warren Commission hearings. And as I've said in a published article, Helms perjured himself before the Warren Commission to conceal the fact about that counterintelligence operation. So the CIA, in a sense, was covering up because it had no choice. It doesn't mean that there were people in the CIA, and I'll name one of them, Angleton, James Angleton, head of counterintelligence. I'm pretty sure he was involved in the conspiracy, but the hard core of the conspiracy may have been elsewhere. I wouldn't be surprised if it had been somewhere in some small agency of the Pentagon, for example. The CIA was behaving almost as if they were embarrassed. And if the CIA was going to plan the whole thing by themselves, I don't think they would have designated a culprit who was sitting in their files from 8 weeks earlier.
Right.
So that's, these things get very deep. The Kennedy assassination was a plot that was piggybacked on top of another plot. When you go down, finally you get a plot that was legitimate. But the people who did the legitimate plot should not be blamed for what happened in the piggyback plot. And that's exactly my analysis of 9/11.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I wanted to just circle back briefly, and I only have a couple more questions for you. I appreciate the time. One quick thing is, you mentioned in relation to Kennedy something about a group called the Circle.
Oh, yes, I did.
This is very interesting to me. I'd like to hear about it.
Well, it's usually Le Cercle in French, because I think the people who first put it together were French, sometimes called Le Cercle, Pinay, P-I-N-A-Y. after a French right-wing French prime minister, former prime minister. They're a group of businessmen. Well, David Rockefeller was the chief American representative. But David Rockefeller is of Europe, plus former heads of intelligence in Europe, put together this group. And I never saw the document, but the first man to write about the circle said there is one of their own documents. In one of their own documents, the circle took credit for the election of
Margaret Thatcher.
Margaret Thatcher, thank you very much. Well, it's risky for 91-year-olds to be talking live.
You're doing great.
They took credit for it. And what I threw out, it interested me that they normally had all of their meetings in France or England. In 1963, they had one in America. And the place they chose for their meeting is Pocantico, which is the huge suburban residence of the Rockefeller family. And David Rockefeller was there. And again, I was told, but this needs to be verified, that one of the agenda items was the problem of America. That's to say, the problem of John F. Kennedy. Mm-hmm. That's all I can say about the circle. But I will add to it a personal anecdote, which David Talbot attaches a great deal of importance to. In 1963, I came to Berkeley in 1961, and I really knew almost nobody. Most of the people I looked up were Poles, because I had just been a Canadian diplomat in Poland, and I met a lot of people who said, oh, you should look up so-and-so in America. One of the people I didn't look up, but who looked me up, was a right-wing Polish colonel. He said, you should come to this nice dinner that's being given by the head of the Hoover Institution in Palo Alto. The Hoover Institution is, there's nothing quite like it. It is all kinds of former right-wingers, thinkers, politicians, etc., end up in one way or another connected to the Hoover Institution. I went to that dinner. The head of the Hoover Institution at that time was another Canadian. And this is the summer of 1963. And what astonished me was that there was really almost only one topic of conversation. And it was, what are we going to do about Kennedy? What are we going to do about Kennedy? That in itself, I think, is interesting. It was really interesting, and I don't know what to make out of it, and David Talbot made more out of it than I do, is that there was, if you can believe, a Russian Jesuit there. What do I mean by a Russian Jesuit? A man who was dressed like an Orthodox priest, but he was actually what we call a uniate, that there are some parts of the Orthodox Church. This is the root of Ukraine's problem, that Eastern Ukraine is Orthodox, responsible to Moscow. Western Ukraine is what we call uniate, Orthodox Christians whose allegiance is to Rome. And this man was one of those uniate. I'd run into them in Warsaw, by the way. They were a presence there. In fact, I met the head of the uniate church in Ukraine in Warsaw. I think there was Western CIA influence in all of that, which may or may not be relevant to what I'm about to say. But this Russian Orthodox calmed the audience and said, stop talking about all this. The old man is going to take care of it. I did hear those words, and I don't know what they meant. David Talbot thinks that he knows what they meant, that the old man was Alan Dulles. Well, it's true. People did call Alan Dulles the old man. People call J. Edgar Hoover the old man. Almost any major organization, the head of it is going to be the old man. It's less likely, I think, to be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, because those people come and go every two or three years. So I would almost rule them out. And
absolutely.
But anyway, for what it's worth, that did help get me interested in the Kennedy assassination. Not as much as the fact that Kennedy, when the Pentagon Papers came out, I found there was something. They reprinted all the most important documents except one. And to me, the most important of all, the one I really wanted to see, was National Security Action Memorandum 273. Its date of passage was November 26, 1963, 4 days after the assassination. And it was pretty clear, if you reconstruct, there were only bits and pieces of it all over the Pentagon Papers, never the whole document. But I reconstructed it from the bits and pieces. And finally, it got declassified by somebody who phoned me about it, who was working on the House on Assassinations. The House Committee on Assassinations got it declassified. Wow. And by golly, it was pretty much what I had said, except there was another part in it about Cambodia, which would have fed my argument, but I wasn't mentioned in the Pentagon Papers, so I didn't know about it.
It completely reversed.
The main thing was Kennedy was going to withdraw troops from Indochina. He was going to. In fact, he authorized an initial withdrawal of 1,000 by the end of 1963. And the coded language of 273, by the way, is authorized by National Security Action Memorandum 263 of, I think, October 22nd, and then quietly and very craftily nullified by 273. And the first page of 273 was given to the New York Times and the Post and published, and it said, "Our intentions remain the same." Well, of course, the intention to withdraw, nobody in the government was planning to keep them there forever, not then. Maybe plans are more, I don't know what the plans are now in Afghanistan, Syria, and so on, and Iraq. But no, the intentions remained the same, but they were not going to withdraw troops. On the contrary, 273 had laid the first plans for escalation of the Vietnam War. This is dated 4 days after the assassination, and it was approved 2 days after the assassination. Oswald was not even murdered yet. That's how closely on it all followed.
Wow.
So that is the deep state that I've always been most worried about. And I'm afraid in appealing to everybody to stop Trump, that's not going to deal with that deep state.
Right.
You remember in 2017, everybody was saying, Congress is hopelessly deadlocked. Congress can't pass anything. Then the defense budget came up and they added almost $1 billion that Trump hadn't asked for. There's no problem gaining consensus when it comes to the American defense budget, because that is the real money that is the feeding trough for politicians in the American political system.
Absolutely. Professor, finally, a definition, about a two-minute definition of continuity of government, so that somebody could understand how this other system could come in on this normal democratic republic system and take over.
Well, it's hard to define something that's so secret that nobody who's talked about it publicly has ever seen it. And the people who have seen it don't talk about it publicly. And that, I think, may explain why Gary Hart, when he's very worried about emergency powers, he surprisingly doesn't say anything about COG, though he knows about them.
Yes.
I listened to a radio broadcast in which the interviewer asked him, "What about COG?" And then Hart did say, yes, he knows that there's COG. I think the price of any knowledge about COG is that your lips are sealed. Mm-hmm. And that is means it's really impossible for me to define, but I can quote what people who have had some knowledge of them and accurately talked about them they focus on three things. I'll go back to a man called Alfonso Chardy, who wrote the original story way back in 1987 in the midst of Iran-Contra in the Miami Herald. First of all, he used the phrase suspension of government. Jack Anderson, even earlier, also used the same phrase, suspension of the government. And then they focus on three things. First one is military government, or its equivalent. It won't be military government, of course, but it would be the use of the armed forces, or of, I shouldn't say the armed forces, of armed forces in ways that we haven't seen. And there's suspension of habeas corpus. And again, the press has never covered the way Muslims were manhandled and abused after 9/11. Almost 1,000 of them were detained. I talked to one of them, and he wasn't even a Sunni Muslim. He was a Shia Muslim. In other words, a part of Islam that nobody has accused of being behind 9/11. He was tortured. He said there was blood in his urine. He was an academic. He was an academic, and they rounded him up, and they were going after everybody. Now, that isn't happening now, I think, but the provisions for the suspension of habeas corpus, which, after all, is mentioned obliquely in the Constitution, and the plans for the suspension of them are in force, and I think would be used if you have large-scale violence, even if it's a violence that doesn't threaten the overthrow of the government. And the third one has to do, I think, with, well, I'm less sure about the third one, but I think I don't even remember what I've written, but I think I say it's control of information or something like that.
Yes.
If that's true, that would help explain why it is that nobody talks about continuity of government and why it's possible that Congress does review it in some kind of pro forma way, but they're not allowed to tell us. And when the very beginning, first time that ever came up in Congress was in the Iran-Contra hearings, and Jack Brooks is a congressman from Texas, and he referred to the Chardy story, and he said, Mr. North, I understand you've been involved in plans for the suspension of the American Constitution. An amazing thing happened then. The chairman banged his gavel, and then Oliver North's lawyer, a civilian, jumped up and said, we can't talk about that here. A civilian lawyer not in the government said, we can't talk about that here.
Incredible.
And they didn't talk about it. And the chairman, Daniel Nui, a decent man, a Democrat from Hawaii, an armed, a very decent man. I'm not accusing him of anything in the government. But he said, we can't talk about this here. And if we're going to do this, we'll have to do so in secret session. And there is no record that there ever was such a secret session. There may have been. But so it sounds as if what Chardy had said was on the money. And then look at the behavior of the New York Times. The New York Times printed every word of the Iran-Contra hearings. So they printed this exchange of remarks about suspension of the American Constitution. They didn't write a news story about it. It wasn't worthy of discussion in the, has all the news it's fit to print, the New York Times. Suspension of the Constitution was obviously some news that wasn't fit to print.
Unbelievable.
That's what we've been living under. We live under a constitution that's living under something else, continuity of government. And we have to find out what continuity of government is. And I'm sorry, Dan, I can't define it. Because no one who's talking at any length has ever seen it.
Why is it called the Doomsday Network?
The Doomsday Network was an actual network that was set up as part of the implementation of COG planning. So if the government is decapitated, you have to have a second network. And we have that network. And I have argued, and it takes too long to explain here, but I've argued, A, that that network is part of the implementation of the Kennedy assassination, and that the biggest biggest, one of the biggest omissions of what went to the Warren Commission, that we got the police tapes on both channels from the Dallas police. We got the tapes from the Dallas sheriffs, but we didn't get the tapes from the White House communications agency that were being used by the Secret Service in some of the cars that were in them in the motorcade. And I argued for the release of those. And we got a review board in 94 that said, I don't know if they said anything. They anyway, that, and then that's also I argued quite independently, forget now the Kennedy assassination, I've argued more cogently that COG planning and COG telephone conversations, which never reached the 9/11 Commission, and which they admit never reached the 9/11 Commission, that was an integral part of the planning for 9/11. I'll just give you one example. Everybody knows that Bush stayed out of Washington for 6 hours. And that meant that the head next in charge of the command system was Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld and Cheney are unaccountable for about 20 minutes before the last plane goes down. And all we know about Cheney was that he was in some other secure area talking by telephone, tapes which were not given to the 9/11 Commission because I'm certain he was using the Doomsday Network. That was the term used by the people who set it up. Doomsday was the atomic attack. The Doomsday Network was what would go into thing there. But it was used on 9/11 beyond a shadow of a doubt. And that's why Cheney went with about 90 people to whatever they call that rock mountain in Maryland, which is all tunneled out underneath. And he lived there for 3 months doing things, drafting, I think, the Patriot Act and drafting plans for Homeland Security, planning for what do they call the project? Anyway, they set up internment camps. We have internment camps in this country that are mostly dusted off from World War II, but they were reactivated, and there are plans for their use if we ever have another anti-war movement.
Incredible. Professor, remarkable information that is so deep and so important as we see all these different forces trying to use COG and influence this election. Of course, as this is being aired, we've learned that President Trump and the First Lady have tested positive for COVID-19. Which adds another twist. And of course, we wish the President and First Lady the best of health. A very dynamic situation unfolding, and Professor Scott's work on continuity of government and COG is so crucial right now to get the real story and understand the deep state. We're going to do part two here as the conversation is going to continue, and we're going to go even deeper. Now, Professor Scott's book, American Deep State, a must read, especially now. You can also visit darkjournalist.com for other interviews I've done with the professor, but it's very rare to get him out, and we really thank him for coming out, and thank you all for joining us. See you soon.